Good afternoon. Oh, that time was a little bit easier. Thank you for your attention. Thank you. Again, I'm Dan Gibbons from the City Club of Chicago, and it's an honor to have this incredible group here today. I just mentioned to our guest of honor, to Lejeune, that we usually open City Club by explaining a little bit of who's in this room. It kind of sets the stage for what we're doing here, why we all come together as this very diverse group of leaders from a diversity of sectors, and coming together to move this city and the state forward. So I'm going to mention a few folks, and if you could hold your applause, because there's so many great people. I wanted to start with Norman Clark, though, from the Chicago African Americans in Philanthropy. And he can, we'll break the rule. So Norman helped Casey and I pull all this together, and so we'll break that rule for a second and let the applause. Thanks, Norman. Priya Shaw is here from The Simple Good. Jim Kirk from Crane's Chicago Business. Blue Pacheco Corneo from Blue Azul. Brenda Bowie from the Chicago Public Library Foundation. Rudy Lozano from J.P. Morgan Chase and a school board member. Julia Stash, a civic giant in Chicago and philanthropic leader. Claire Koneman from Ketchum and also the Council General of Monaco. Claire, thank you. Gabe Lyons here from Illinois Humanities. Abby McCormick O'Neill is here from, she's also a legendary civic and philanthropic leader. Thank you for joining us and a great member of City Club. Lori Demune from the Harris Theater, the CEO of the Harris Theater is here. Julie Marita is here, the Joyce Foundation. I mentioned them as a sponsor. Julie and Nicole and their team are here. And you might want to come back for Julie's program. She's speaking at the Advance Illinois State, the State of Education Report on Public Education on October 1st. I think it's sold out, but we always hold seats for our members, so you can always become a member and try to get a seat there. There's another gentleman here who I believe I haven't seen him, but Daniel Ash, the head of the Field Foundation. Daniel's here. He's also speaking. He is speaking on October 15th about measuring impact or mismeasuring impact in the nonprofit sector. October 15th. How could we forget? She's always a mayor to me, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. Thank you, Mayor Wilson, Mayor Freeman Wilson, for joining us from the Chicago Urban League, of course. That's just a little sampling, right, of who's here. And it always helps, especially if we have speakers that are from out of town or other leaders that are here to understand who's here. And at City Club, we really bring the right leaders together to move Chicago forward. What a world we're living in. What a time we're living in. What an incredible city we're living in, right? And it's times like these, and it's programs like this, and it's people like you all of you in this room, who remind us of how much good is going on, right? How much good there is in the world, and especially in Chicago. It's people like all that I mentioned, business and labor leaders, you know, who are employing and innovative, it's government and elected officials that we bring together, who are leading and creating policies, academics who study history to try to help determine the future, community leaders who are really rolling up their sleeves and doing amazing work in the communities. And, of course, philanthropists who support all that I just mentioned to move Chicago forward. There's so much good happening, yet there's so much work to be done. And when we do come together, like we do here at City Club, with a common goal of improving our city, improving our society, big things can happen. And I hope they will as a result of today's discussion. So thank you for being here at City Club, for being a part of this conversation, and to hear from these two incredible leaders. I have a host of questions that have been submitted. I know we're going to get right to the conversation. And if you do have any questions, please grab me or myself or Caleb is around the room, and get those up to us, because we're going to try to answer a few at the end of this conversation. I also wanted to make a special thanks to the Joint Affinity Group, which works to advance, you know, equity for historically marginalized and disinvested communities. I mentioned Norman and the Chicago African Americans in philanthropy. I also want to mention Chicago Latins in philanthropy. Alberto Morales is here, and also the Asian American Pacific Islanders in philanthropy. Rupal Soni is here. This was a partnership, and this is how we create these programs. We work with members and partners to bring the most incredible people and the best speakers to this stage. And I appreciate that partnership. We appreciate those ideas and all of you coming together today. So with all of that, I'd like to welcome to the stage. We'll start with Casey. How about that? Casey Atairo is the Chief External Affairs Officer at the Joyce Foundation, where she directs strategic communications and the journalism program and the Lend a Hand Grants Fund. She's a former award-winning journalist and has also led communications in government and politics. She's widely recognized here at City Club and in Chicago as one of our most influential civic leaders. So please welcome Casey Atairo. Good. Lejeune Montgomery Tabron is the president and the CEO of the WK Kellogg Foundation, one of the largest private foundations in the country, where she leads efforts in supporting thriving children, working families, and equitable communities, things that we talk about here all the time. First African-American to head the foundation, she's also a national thought leader on racial equity and healing at a time when it needs to be talked about more than ever. She's recognized by Time Magazine in 2025 as one of the 100 most influential people in philanthropy. And she is going to join us on our City Club stage. Please welcome Lejeune Montgomery Tabron.
Hello. Thank you, Dan. And thank you all for being here. Special thank you to Lejeune. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And, you know, as Dan said, you know, we have been on quite the weather run in Chicago, right? Like the last few days. And I was just thinking today just how beautiful our city is and how beautiful our people are and how it belies the ugliness that we've been facing in recent days, from unprecedented and unwarranted aggression and attempts at intimidation. And, you know, the main idea of those actions is to divide us. But what they don't know is that the character of our city is greater than any caricature created by outsiders. And we are not taking the bait. And so today's conversation is a timely and important counter-programming, focusing on what unites us and how we can achieve progress in solidarity with each other. And I'm so glad to be in this conversation here with Lejeune. So I want to kick off the discussion with a practice that I learned from your book. If you don't know, Lejeune recently released a wonderful book called How We Heal, which is part memoir of her incredible journey as the first Black and first female CEO of the Kellogg Foundation. You can clap for that. And part how-to in navigating challenging times on a path that's true to your values and that's continuing to build, to bend the moral arc. And so there's a practice in the book called conocimiento, which means knowledge or wisdom in Spanish. And it's an intentional way to get to know someone by asking a question that helps us see our common humanity. So I'm going to start with the question that Lejeune likes to start with, which is, what is the story of your name?
And thank you so much. And good afternoon, everyone. Yes, it's afternoon. This room is just an amazing space. I'm so happy to have been invited to be in this space with all of you. And I want us all to leave very inspired and encouraged by where we are as a people, and all of us as people. So, as you were saying, conocimiento is how we get to know one another. It's part of the healing process. And so the meaning of my name gives you a meaning of my soul. It's how to connect. And my first name, Lejeune, was a name given to me by my mother. My family has a military background, and some of you may have known and heard about Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. So she heard of that Camp Lejeune and thought that was a beautiful name, and so my first name is named from that space. Montgomery is my maiden name that I have kept because I don't have a middle name. But Montgomery is, I think of as my legacy, my background, and it comes from, my parents were from Clarksdale, Mississippi. They moved north, migrated north. Some went to Detroit, some went to Chicago. So this is my second home where my family resides. But before, my ancestor, Isaiah T. Montgomery, founded a place in Mississippi called Mound Bayou, Mississippi. And Mound Bayou, Mississippi was one of the first places where African Americans, freed slaves, were able to thrive. It was one of the most affluent places in Mississippi in the late 1800s. And my ancestor knew that it was possible for our people to thrive and to build wealth. And that's the town that he created. Unfortunately, that town was destroyed systematically because the backlash from that wealth was not welcomed. But I am an ancestor of that leader and that legacy, so I carry that name with me that gives me my strength to continue to lead. And then my maiden, my married name is Tabron, and that is my husband that was my high school sweetheart. And then we separated, and then we came back together. So one of those true love stories that we can talk about at another talk. But if you most people like to talk about that more than everything else. But for another time. But, you know, that's a way from now on when we meet. That's a way to connect. Some people come up afterwards and say, well, I'm from a military background also. And all we're really trying to do is find commonality in our humanity. And that's the narrative that we want to start. That's the truth-telling that we want to share and how we want to begin to build relationships. So, Casey.
Yes.
Why don't you tell me the origin of your name?
Sure. So my first name, Casey, is spelled the way it is as an homage to my mom, whose middle name is Kay. My last name, Atayero, is actually a Nigerian royal tribal name. And my great-great-grandfather was king of our village, Elisha, for a number of years until there was a coup. And then we lost all our money. So I'm sort of the people's princess. You know, it's kind of like elected officials. Like, you keep your title no matter what. You know. And fun fact, the only Atayeros in the world are relatives of mine because it is a family tribal name, and I am the only Casey Atayero in the world.
Wonderful. There's that.
See, that was, I like that. I've never actually told that story, so it's pretty cool.
It's wonderful.
Okay, racial healing. That's what brings us here this afternoon.
Yes.
And there are a lot of preconceptions and misconceptions about what that is. So why don't you just sort of ground us in what racial healing is and how it works?
Okay, yes. Again, I don't think I have to preach to this room, but racial healing for us is a tool. And when we talk about it, we say racial healing is the pathway to achieve racial equity in our communities, in the nation, in the world. And we say that because the healing process is the process by which we connect through our humanity. And it's a space where we are connecting and building trusting relationships with one another. And through that process, we begin to close what we call the empathy gap. As we know, we have been separated through structures very intentionally so that we don't get to know one another, so that we don't have shared experiences. And it's easier to create false narratives about the other when there is no grounding or relationship that we share. So the healing process is reconnecting people who have been separated, allowing us to build trusting relationships, sharing our true narratives of who we are, listening to others, and building a bond that we can then utilize to dismantle those systems that are not equitable so that our children and families can thrive. And of course, when we say racial equity, we mean a world by which every child, every family can pursue their most greatest aspiration and have opportunities to thrive, and they won't be judged by the color of their skin or their zip code or their sexuality, etc. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about racial equity, it's very universal. And that's one thing that's very clear about our work. We're talking about everyone. We're talking about connecting our common humanity. And we're talking about then building relationships and community so people can work together to transform systems that aren't serving them any longer. And that's why today we continue to do this work with no capitulation at all, because we know what we're doing is totally legal, and it is about the universal space of our humanity.
So, let's talk a little bit about the moment in which you're doing this work. And particularly, you know, it can be challenging to think about healing in a moment when so many of our communities are in active hurt, right? So how do you begin that process when folks are currently in harm's way?
Yeah, and, you know, the first thing that I think we need to do is understand that the narrative that we see is not the full narrative, and that there are thriving communities today. There are people who are doing this work of healing today. There are transformative systems that are being shaped and created throughout this nation. And that's where I get a lot of hope. And I think part of the work is sharing these stories and helping us see the good that's still happening throughout our nation, and then learning from those and connecting these movements together. What I believe is the power of the transformation that we need today is in the people. And it's in all of us, and it's in people and communities all over this nation. And what people need is information and knowledge. They need solidarity. They need resources. And we need to know that there is hope and there is a pathway forward. And it starts with some of the healing work to reconnect our communities to one another. So we know that what we hear right now seems dire and depressing. But on the other hand, in all of our communities, especially right here in Chicago, there's work going on that is amazing work that's building a movement among the community and the people. And we just need to reach out to those. We need to align with these efforts, and we need to continue to build the strength of our common and our shared humanity and the work that we can do together.
So I can imagine when you say what you just said, in some spaces, you get some pushback. particularly be good because people, you know, people are in fight mode. What would you say to them about why this work is a must-have and not a nice-to-have?
Yeah, and it's what we don't know. It's like our unconscious understanding. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. As I've been going around sharing the book and talking about this work, of course you see people who say, that's kind of soft stuff, and we don't have time for that. The world is burning. and there is that. Mm-hmm. But what I tend to do in those moments is to kind of anchor us in a present situation. And I had a recent conversation like that, and this was someone who is a very good friend of mine, a Caucasian woman. And as we were kind of leaning into this conversation, what I learned from her and what she was trying to share with me was she wanted to challenge my thinking that when certain things happen, that I automatically go to race as a reason. It's like, okay. And so we had a conversation about situations where she would say, well, are you sure that was race? Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes. but the point of the conversation and was, one, to have a conversation where you can say there can be more than one truth. Mm-hmm. My truth is my truth, mm-hmm. and your truth may be different, mm-hmm. but that doesn't discount my truth and my feelings mm-hmm. and how I feel from a circumstance. And, you know, you may disagree, but you can't debate my feelings. Mm-hmm. I'm having the feelings, not you. And so as we were going through this conversation, the good news is at the end of the conversation, we agreed that two truths could be true and that we both could hear a different perspective and yet at the end say, okay, now that we understand where you're coming from and I understand, can we still work on this? And the answer was, yeah, because that's still wrong. Mm-hmm. And I agree that that's wrong. So, and that's what the healing process is all about. It's not debating with someone. It's not blaming or shaming. Actually, the healing methodology is about affirmation. It's affirming one's point of view. And actually, through that affirmation, getting to a point of commonality and then a shared purpose, shared understanding, and shared action. Because it is about action. It's not just to feel good. It's about, now, how do we work to transform what is a problem today? So I have done this work with, you know, people who just are never in a situation where they can have these kinds of conversations. And what we've been doing is creating the safe space, creating pathways and openings so that you can have a conversation, even with someone who you may think you're in sync with. Mm-hmm. A deeper level conversation, non-transactional. We have too many transactional conversations, mm-hmm. and we don't get down to the real mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. We can ask a question that can get us into a deeper space, and that gives us that foundational alignment mm-hmm. that we need when the road gets tough. Like when the crisis is on, we need mm-hmm. to trust that our people are with us in solidarity as we move this work forward. Mm-hmm. And that's why this healing work, and I'm so hopeful, because we've been doing this for over decades mm-hmm. and decades. So I know that foundation is present and it's going to get drawn upon in these moments of heat. Mm-hmm. And we know who we can trust. We know who's with us as we continue to strategize together.
I want to go back to a point you made about naming, blaming, and shaming, and it was in the book. And you tell us that we can't do that. And there are moments in which I want to, you know, name, blame, shame, and point.
Yeah.
Because people will say and do crazy things.
Yeah.
How do you resist that urge?
Yeah.
You know, especially when I'm sure people come up and say just the craziest things. How do you sort of bring it back to, like, your center and your space?
I smile. And there's a methodology that we share. And actually, in the book, in the back of the book, we share the entire methodology. We share conversation guides on how to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. But there's a methodology in the book that I really love, and it's where we say, turn to wonder. Mm-hmm. And when someone says something that you may think, what? You turn to wonder. And the response is, how can you share with me how you've gotten to that point? Or what does that mean to you when you say that? Because that may be different than what I hear and what I may think it means. Mm-hmm. But to take a moment where your first reaction is to clap back and turn to wonder and turn it into a conversation. Mm-hmm. And by the time you change the course of that conversation, you end up learning something that you didn't already know. And even if it's just to learn something to be prepared for further conversations or moments, but it's a part of it, and it's not about blaming or shaming. Mm-hmm. It is about just trying to get to a deeper level of knowing. That's what conocimiento is mm-hmm. that deeper level of knowing that you can then pivot from.
LeJune is playing to our better angels. I love it. Despite its promise, Chicago is a city that continues to grapple with a legacy of racialized public policy that has created uneven outcomes for its people. How can the tools of racial healing help cities reckon with and overcome these historic injustices? Like, where have you seen it work?
Yeah, and it has worked in many places. The one that I talk about a lot, and I share a little about in the book as well, is Flint, Michigan. And you all have all heard of the tragedies in Flint, Michigan. But Flint, Michigan is also one of our Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation communities. And we've been working with Flint for many, many years. And there's two incidents that I will talk about that really shows the power of this work, because we were working in Flint during the water crisis, and their TRHT communities were active. And you all know the lack of trust that was occurring in that time in Flint. And what we were doing in Flint was supporting healing circles in the neighborhoods, across administrators. And one of the things about our TRHT communities, and some of you here are in the one in Chicago, so you know when we were starting out, we wanted a very diverse group of people participating. It couldn't just be people in the neighborhood. We wanted administrators, public officials, faith-based, you know, teachers. Every sector needed to be represented. And so we were working through all those sectors during the water crisis, which led to some very agile strategies getting clean water and access to water and access to health care to the people of Flint because of the connections that we had made through the work. Well, that was great, and we felt really good about that. But then the pandemic hit. And once again, Flint was a place that was devastated. But the interesting thing about that time was when the vaccines were available, we had more people in Flint trusting the system and getting vaccines, where we had people elsewhere not. Mm-hmm. And part of that was because of that TRHT system and healing work that they had been doing, where the trust level was much higher in that place. And you probably saw on the news where the police officer kneeled in Flint and apologized to the community for the behaviors that had happened there. And that was all a part of the work that we have been doing long before these crises. And I won't go into Buffalo, but you all remember the shootings there. And again, we have been working in Buffalo way before that happened. And the only thing I'll mention is when we reached out to them after the shootings, the first thing we were told was, the best thing we need right now is more healing practitioners. Mm-hmm. because they were in the communities working in the neighborhoods and healing and having sessions and healing circles. And, you know, what I was told again is there could have been a violent response, and instead it wasn't. You didn't hear, you didn't see a lot of the rioting afterwards, and it was because they had been doing this work in the community. So I've seen where this work can change the course of relationships in a community, and at the end of the day, it all is about relationships, trust building and relationships. And if they don't exist, they really don't exist when things get bad. So what we're what we've been doing is working when things are even keel to build those kind of ground, on the ground relationships that will take us through tough times. And again, as I sit here in Chicago, I know this work is happening here, and I know we're going to need to lean on this work as times may change for our people and our communities.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. I want to shift gears a bit and talk about your personal journey, and particularly your arc within Kellogg. And so when you joined the foundation in the late 1980s, you were one of the only full-time employees of color on staff. And the foundation took great pains to avoid talking openly about race. And for those of you who have been moving the racial equity work forward in your organization, there were parts of the book that she talks about this work, it will ring true. Like, we all have our hand on that same boulder trying to push it up the hill, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, your leadership, you know, breaking barriers had a lot to do with that. Can you share a little bit about what that journey was like for you and what advice you have for other folks who have their hand on that boulder?
Yes. So when I started at the foundation, there weren't many people like us there. There weren't many people in philanthropy of color. It was an interesting time. But my foundation had decided that they wanted to reflect the communities that they serve. And so they had begun to hire people from those communities, and I was one. I came in at the foundation as the controller. I have a finance background, so I was the controller. But once, you know, they hired a few of us, they kind of didn't know what to do with us. And literally, I had someone come up and say to me, "You're different." And I was like, "How am I different?" And she meant I was different from the people of color she sees on the news. I'm like, actually, I'm not very different. There are a lot of me out there and my whole family and my, you know, I'm not really different. So there were those kind of conversations at the beginning. But, you know, the foundation honestly wanted to reflect community. They just didn't know how. And one of the things about the book is a lot of people want to do this work. They just don't know how. So we kind of were just struggling, and we iterated a lot. We learned a lot. We failed a lot. But we were committed to the end goal. I was, you know, 24 when I started working at the foundation. At about 26 maybe, they appointed me, you know, on the diversity advisory committee and eventually the chair. And I really didn't have a clue at 24 what to do. But I did know that we had a goal and we needed to reach that goal. And I became kind of the truth teller for that goal. And I took on this role very earnestly because I don't do anything half. So I was committed, and there were times where I might have been the only person committed, but I was like, no, we said we were going to do this. We are going to do this. And as I would bring issues, and this is what I want to share with maybe some of you, but it was kind of like a shoot the messenger moment at the beginning. So I would meet with the people, and then they would tell me all the things that were wrong, and they had all these lists, and I would take it back to the executive and say, these are the things that are wrong. They shoot at me and say, you know, it was always my fault. Don't bring any more of these lists back here. I'm like, no. I thought that's what I was supposed to do, was develop the list, and we were going to work on them. And, you know, it was tough because that's truth telling. And people didn't want to hear the truth at the beginning. And, you know, I was kind of getting sabotaged in the middle. But then finally, I got a breaking point. But instead of breaking away, what I said is I went to the president. And every meeting he would say, LeJune, what does the people say? And I would say it, and then he said, well, I don't think there's anything we can do about that. And I said, well, you know what, this time I quit. I'm not doing this work anymore. I'm not bringing another list to this room where you all can all shoot the list down and think I'm crazy. So I say we disband the whole committee, don't let anybody meet anymore, and I'm not bringing any more lists. And he kind of laughed, and then he's like, she's serious. And I said, I'm done. You know, I came here to be a finance person, and you guys aren't serious. And we actually disbanded the committee, and everyone in the organization kind of took a gasp, right? And I said, we'll reconvene when it's real. But that pause really helped bring value and purpose to the work. And we did reconvene, but it was, you know, after I said, you know, you're not going to throw me up on a target and shoot at me because you're not treating our people right. This is work we have to do together. And, of course, we kept on the journey. And decades later, our foundation was the first foundation to proclaim by our board that we will be an anti-racist organization inside and out, and everything we do will be about anti-racism. And again, we made it because we were truthful. We practiced everything we espoused. We supported in community, but we also did it. So we had our own healing circles. We gave voice to people. We made sure that everyone was heard. We listened when we were wrong, and we shifted. We were vulnerable. And it took a while, but over time, the organization now practices what it preaches. We are about 51% people of color. And, you know, very talented, remarkable team of individuals working hard because they know they work for an organization that stands by its values, that's committed to the mission. What we say is what we do, and we do it with the people all over the nation and the world, our grantees. So. Yeah.
There was something related to that. You said, I've had the privilege of spending most of the day today with LeJune, so it's been quite the treat for me. And when we talked a little bit about this earlier, and you were talking about the role of meritocracy, right? Like, yes. It isn't either. Can you sort of talk about how you look at, you know, the balance of, like, diversity and meritocracy?
Yeah, and, you know, what I said earlier is we hired the best. And we don't have a problem recruiting the best because everyone wants to work for an organization that's committed and is a values-based organization. And that's what we are. So as we look at today and we look at what is being deemed as illegal practices around DEI, we stand proud and say we are doing nothing illegal. Everyone in our organization is overqualified, very well qualified for their positions. They're doing amazing work, and we stand very firm in making sure that we are fully compliant, but fully reflective of all the communities and the people that we serve with the brightest talent and the greatest skill set. So we're very happy about that, and are continuing to do this work the same way. Yes, we haven't changed anything because we continue to do what we know is right for children and families.
Thank you for that. Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to underscore that, because often when you have conversations about diversity or, you know, DEI or whatever, it's always framed as an either or, right? Like a trade-off. And like, no, it's a both and it's a plus,
yeah,
right? So that's what I wanted to
And say. It's not a program. It is a way of being. It is embedded in everything we do. It is about our humanity. And so there's nothing to discontinue. We have to do and be the organization we are for the people and families we serve. And it is about bringing like-minded people together who are working to improve systems so that everyone can thrive. And if it's not a program, there's nothing to stop. So,
yeah, it's true. That is very true. As you know, many leaders today are cautious about talking about what we've been talking about this afternoon. What would you say to those leaders about why it is essential to step into this work and how they can do so in ways that are both strategic for their organization and true to their values?
Yeah, and we have been talking to many companies, many organizations, and what we know is that those who have taken this work as part of their business imperative, there is no going back. They see the business case. They see the value of having diversity in thought and perspective, how that leads to better outcomes. And that's proven. That's researched. And so where people have understood that to be the case, that competitive advantage is nothing that they want to walk away from. So what we know is that many people understand this, and they're looking at it as embedding it fully within the organization and not having it be this standalone that can get chopped off and come back and chopped off again, et cetera. And, you know, I think that's the case as well for us. It is, you have to think about this as the way your organization is structured, and you're reaping the benefits. And we know in our organization, because we track it, we measure it, we know we're reaping benefits and having great outcomes and better outcomes because of all the insights and perspectives that we've brought into the organization to make sure we're doing so. And it can be measured, and you can know that you're getting the great results that you're getting.
Thanks for that. Okay, so given that we're holding this conversation in partnership with Chicago Philanthropy's Joint Affinity Group, as Dan mentioned earlier, I'd like to talk about the role of intersectionality in racial healing. Your book is told, of course, through the lens, through your lens as a Black woman, but you hold a lot of space, right, for the history of racial injustice experienced by other groups, by Asian, Latino, and Indigenous communities. And it's interesting because the stories are told as unique journeys forming a common bond.
Right.
Why was it important to illustrate that?
It's very important. And again, that's why we stand so firm in this work, because we've been doing this now for 95 years. This hasn't been anything that was started in any recent time. You know, we were one of the largest funders of Native American communities in the country, because we were seeing the encroachment of our Indigenous people, and we wanted to support that as part of all children thriving. And we talk about some of the great work we've been doing there. Our work in New Mexico, our work in Mississippi in the South, all of this work isn't anything new for us. It's how we've been reaching into every part of our country and the nation and the world, and thinking about how do we understand and learn how to make sure that everyone thrives. So our work has always been very universal, and the examples we share is that this work is universal. You know, some of the healing circle principles are from the Indigenous people, that we've borrowed and built a methodology that works and respects how communities actually work. We're not trying to impose things on communities that don't naturally exist in the order of cultures and people coming together. And so, you know, it's been built not by us per se. Hundreds of grantees work with us to perfect this, to make sure that it reflects how communities' systems work. Mm-hmm. And then now we're helping support their practice and for them to use it to make the transformation that they want. So one of the things that I did a little bit into my tenure as the president, which has been for the last 12 years, is I wanted to have access to this tapestry, what I believe, of insight and thought. So I created this group. It's called SCORE, and it's the Solidarity Council on Racial Equity. And it needed to reflect as broad of diversity as we could. So we went out and we looked at thought leaders of all different racial backgrounds and in different spaces of the work, and we brought them all together and said, will you come and help us think together about how we can support one another, how we can no longer be divided, how do we measure up, how do we come together and learn the act of solidarity so that collectively we are strong and that we can support the work of any of us toward whatever end we have. And that's been going on now for about a decade, and the results of that is truly amazing, because the ideas are very fluid. And they're across every racial identity. And in fact, their collective idea is work that we've supported around the Next 250. And the Next 250 body of work is about communities and people coming together and envisioning together what they would like our nation to be for them in the next 250 years. We're going to celebrate our first 250 years next year. What should the next 250 look like for all of us? And they've been traveling all over the nation, every place within the nation, and together they're going to create what they call a new declaration of interdependence, where people will be about the collective nature of our humanity. And that's work that's happening right now, and again, it's what gives me a lot of hope. Because we know people are working together. They're standing up together, and they believe that systems can work for everyone. Yeah. And that's what that work is about.
Yeah, it's that, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So we've talked sort of broadly about racial healing, and we've talked about healing, specific examples of healing within communities. I'd like to talk about your own healing process. In what way did writing this book help you heal?
Many ways. There were things, I said it was cathartic going through this process, because there were things that I didn't even realize I needed to heal from, that I had to heal from to get through the process. And, you know, one of the things I started with was, and this is, I'm still healing from this in this moment, because the book starts with me talking about the 1967 riots in Detroit. And, you know, those riots were the result of the people in Detroit rebelling against police brutality and their rights to demonstrate. So it's a real circle moment for me. But right after the riots, my next-door neighbor, who happened to be a white family, and my best friend happened to be a young daughter of this family that was about my age, she and I had been friends since I was born, and was just a great friendship that two people who lived next to each other in a neighborhood would have. Every day, all day, we spent the night. But right after the riots, that family moved away. And since, I've never seen this young woman again, ever, but we were best friends. I mean, we played every day together, like family. And at the time, you know, I was young, 5 or 6 years old, and I just knew she had moved away. We were sad. My parents didn't dwell on it. They were just gone. Yeah. But later, as I was understanding what really happened, and I understand the whole structures of housing and housing policy that was part of this process where they were able to move with the white flight movement and seek a home in a better neighborhood that was continuing to add value, whereas we were in the city and were not able to relocate and be as mobile. So, you know, at the time, that just hurt. I was just a little kid, and I lost my best friend. I didn't care about all these policies or anything. But it made me think about, what are we doing to our children? And how are our children being impacted to these things that they see and they don't understand? And, you know, how do we care for them while we're, you know, trying to care for ourselves and trying to work toward our survival? But this is multi-layered. And for me, things had just not been explained. And I think my parents just thought that's best not to explain it. But there's care for children that I think we also need to think about. And one of the reasons why we support in Chicago, Communities United, which is an effort that we are supporting where it's young people who are working in our communities around healing for justice. And they're working on mental well-being and healthcare and healing for our young people. Because we pass by these traumatic events. We don't think they're traumatic, but they are for young people. And when they're not cared for, you don't know when those things are going to revisit the soul. And, you know, for me, it was, dang, they had to move, you know. So, and there are times like that where I reflect on over my journey where I didn't quite understand what was happening. But now I do, and it gives me a little bit of forgiveness around the hurt from losing that relationship.
You know, I was, there were many things in your book that stuck with me, but I was particularly struck by the optimism, particularly given, you know, many of the episodes of just like flat out racism, you know, discrimination, injustice that you faced. There were times I had to put the book down because I was mad, right?
I know.
I just had to step away for a minute and come back.
Yeah.
And so, what drives your relentless faith in humanity despite all of that?
Yeah, partly because I feel like I'm close to it and I see it working. I do believe that the mainstream narrative is not the full picture. We're not seeing what's truly happening in our communities, and I think it's part of our responsibility to share those narratives about the positive side of what's going on. And there is a lot of good going on, and you all know and can talk about the good. We need to share that more. We need to own that narrative and make sure that that narrative is available for our people in our communities and for the people that we need to inspire to continue to do this work. And that's why I'm really hopeful. I'm hopeful because I see it. I'm hopeful because I see young people who are ready to take the mantle and feel very confident and strong about their capabilities, and I'm ready for them to have their space. I'm very hopeful about that as well. And in fact, to that point, we are hosting a conference.
Yes.
Right here in Chicago next year, June of 2026. And it's called Thrive Fest, and it's about young people, and it's about how we are going to support and encourage our young people to thrive. And this will be a one-of-a-kind, unique experience. Young people will be in the driver's seat. It will also be a place where we will see young leadership at its brightest, at its best. And it will be different than any other conference experience, hopefully, that you've ever had, because you won't be sitting in a room like this listening to one person talk. It'll be very fluid. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
And it'll be a place to really energize that movement for young people. And we're so happy to support it.
We're looking forward to that. Okay, so Dan is giving me the high sign.
Yeah.
One last question. I know many folks in this room, I mean, they're here, right, because they want to be part of the change.
Yeah.
What is one small, meaningful step that someone could take to start building that connective tissue in their communities for racial healing?
Yeah. So, yeah, you guys represent amazing organizations that are doing this work just as we are. And one place you can start is just within your own organization. And go back and, you know, have one of these conversations with someone that you haven't quite had a conversation with. And, you know, it could start with a conocimiento. Mm-hmm. And from there, you can go a little deeper and get to the point of why and learn a little bit more about someone that that you know.
That you think you know.
You think you know them, but they may need to be your ally.
Yeah.
And you need to start working on those allies in a productive way. And that will help you build confidence that they are an ally. And when the going gets tough, you can go back there and continue that conversation. So we can do that within our organizations. We can do that within our friends and our families. But believe me, it's a small step, but really it's a big step. Because most of the vulnerability and healing is for yourself. And you got to work on yourself. And you have to be comfortable not only with sharing, but with listening.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, is not as easy to do as sharing, actually. Yeah. But listening to someone else and actually learning something, listening for the purpose of learning, mm-hmm. not for the purpose of speaking next.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
What a great way to end.
Yeah.
We always like to include questions from the audience, and there are many. But you did touch on so many of them already. I think I could go with my canned City Club question, which is, will you come back?
I'm home.
You're welcome home anytime. Yeah. Maybe when the Bears play the Lions, we'll...
I'll come when the Bears play the Lions. You all have to let the Lions win, but that'll be fine.
That was amazing, and there are so many more. I'm gonna let that one lie there. Yeah. It is Monday Night Football tonight. Bears season opener, by the way. How We Heal is this was so generously you have brought some books with you. I don't know how you carried them all here, but every one of you is welcome to take one on the way out from the Kellogg Foundation. Thank you. Thank you to the Kellogg Foundation for that. Thank you, of course, to the Joyce Foundation. I will mention also there is another book. For those of you who have kids, look this one up. I grabbed one I'm going to share with my boys, but it's called Our Differences Make Us Stronger, How We Heal Together, and it's geared towards children. So we can all share these insights and have these conversations and continue this conversation. We do love to have the difficult conversations here at City Club, and this was absolutely incredible. One of the questions that was submitted was how do we get invited to the table? Was basically, you know, how do we get invited? And I just want to say you are invited here. All of you are invited here. And I'm going to invite City Club ourselves to the Thrive Fest somehow or another.
Right.
We'd like to collaborate with you. We'd like to be involved there. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But those are the sorts of things. Keep showing up. Keep mm-hmm. trying. Keep inviting people that are doing good things to come and listen to these. And not just listen. Involve yourselves in these incredible conversations with leaders like you two, who we're so, so fortunate to have here at City Club.
Thank you.
And please do come back. As I mentioned, we've got a great month coming up. Tomorrow we're having a program on the current state of immigration. We have the Architectural Biennial on September 11th, Closing the Housing Gap in Chicago on the 22nd, Cook County Sheriff on the 23rd, the Water Commissioner talking about all sorts of interesting things with water. That's on the 30th of September. Advance Illinois, I mentioned with Julie Morita and others, on October 1st. I don't know when I'm going to find any time to read this book. Mismeasuring impact in the nonprofit sector on the 15th, and then Ambassador Rahm Emanuel on the 23rd. We've got a lot to discuss, and these are all deep conversations. They're not all easy, but we hope you'll join us. You'll hope you'll come again. And, of course, LeJune Montgomery Tabron, we are so excited to have you back here. Casey, I know we're going to see you very soon.
Yes.
And please, close us out.
Yes, if I get a little moderator privilege, I just wanted to thank LeJune so much. This has been such an honor for me. I have admired you from afar, and I'm now officially a fangirl up close. So thank you. I want to thank the Kellogg team. Rockstars, as a staffer, I know that it is the team that make the magic happen. So I want to thank my fellow magicians for helping to make this happen. And one of the greatest thrills today is having gotten so many hugs from the people in this room. And you cannot do this work unless you stand on the shoulders of and stand shoulder to shoulder with incredible people. And I am so privileged to have so many of you standing with me and here supporting with me today. And I could not thank you enough. I love you all.
Thank you. Have a great week, everybody. Thank you.